Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, warriors of all ages, those that are retired, still on active duty, the family members. We're back with Warrior Connection, back with education, information, and discussion. The whole thing is to empower you to survive and thrive in your life, get information that you need. The New Army Times came out this week, and as I was reading it, I got to the back page of it, and it said, the number of vets who took their lives in 2014, this is the final count, 2014, was over 7,400 veterans committed suicide during the fiscal year 2014. That's an increase of suicide rates of 32% in the veterans as compared to 23% in civilians, and increase in suicide rates among women, 85% increase. 85% increase in suicides by women. Well, when we look at this, it's an ongoing problem that never seems to end. Our local newspaper here, the News Gazette in Champaign, Illinois, every Monday, they run a story about a veteran from all the time frames. And the one that was in the one for this week, again, is about a U.S. Marine, a door gunner in the U.S. Marines on a Huey. So this guy's got a bad life all the way around. And I'm going to just read this direct quote because it's the only way we got to understand this to begin the discussion. He found himself unwelcome outside his military circle. He became addicted to drugs and committed crimes to get money to buy them. Only recently, with the help of counselors of the Veterans Affairs Illiana Healthcare System in Danville, as he come to grips with his panic attacks and suppressed terrors, his wife heard him muttering in his sleep. His enlistment ran from 1969 to 1973. The hardest was a time in Vietnam, 1970 to 71. Wearing the uniform that made him so proud, he landed in Continental Airline near Da Nang and without immediately was in the thick of it. He encountered racism and the enemy's propaganda effort of shooting white soldiers and white Marines first. It was months after he first fired his machine gun at the enemy before he saw anything but blood trails. They were like ghosts, he says. But in the attack, when he fired off all of his rounds, he saw body parts everywhere, and still they kept coming. Viet Cong and North Vietnamese regulars gave as good as they got, he said. And he saw a U.S. soldier disintegrate when he was hit by a Russian-made rocket. The Viet Cong carried rocket launchers that were taller than we were, he recalls. And he just goes on, and then he goes on. Alcohol and drugs were everywhere. A can of beer cost 15 cents. You could be drunk on base at any time, he said. And drugs were there were stronger than more plentiful in America. His life for a few years after leaving the Marines was muddled by addiction and alcohol. And he finally got his act together here just recently, hence the newspaper report. This is too prevalent, isn't it, Bob?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The addiction is the number one health concern in our nation right now, whether it be for military service members or the civilian population.
Dr. Shaw, in all the work you've done, when you're trying to deal with addiction and you're dealing with PTSD and the consequences mm-hmm. of war and everything, mm-hmm. yes, the question we have to ask is anybody really prepared to go in this situation? And when they get into this situation and encounter these horror and the nightmare, then they come back home without any support functions. I mean, it seems to those of us that some of us went through it, some of us, we had a good support system and family life ahead of the time, we did okay. But if there was no support system ahead of the time, then they went in, it just crashes and burns. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, it is. A support system is incredibly important for anyone who's struggling through addiction or trauma. But and if a soldier or a Marine, airman, or seaman have what they believe to be no support system, then coming back from deployment, they're going to feel that much more vulnerable. And I have, in my experience, have seen many military service members want to go back into deployment because at least that's a familiar scene for them, despite the fact that it was traumatized.
I know I did. Ray, did you?
Yeah, I certainly did. And I think part of what that is, too, Doug, that, you know, when you're with a close combat or a close group of people, that there's a little bit of security within that itself, and you miss that security.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, when you come back out and you see so many lines are kind of spiraling out of control, it makes you want to be back where you've got some type of control.
Yeah, and if somebody is coming back from deployment and they've had a traumatic experience, they come back into civilian life, even though they still may be active duty and on post or on base, their family support, maybe their church support, they're going to feel like they have no idea what I've just been through. They're not going to understand anything that I am feeling or sensing, and they almost talk themselves out of receiving the support that can come their way.
That's true. Doctor, what I explain it to them a lot of times is that I said we were born into a place called Disney World that is different from anywhere else in this world. We're like in America, fortunately, we're blessed. We have parties and laughter and just a lot of freedoms and stuff. And when you leave that and go into a third world country where they see black and white, when you spend time there, especially if you're in any type of combat, you come back home to Disney World and you still see black and white, and so you don't fit in. It takes a long time, and you become antisocial and everything else, you know, because of the experiences you dealt with.
And there's such a high link and a strong link between traumatization or PTSD and the pursuit of addictions. And perhaps maybe a definition of trauma can help understand that, for example. Trauma is the intense fear, loss of control, feeling of helplessness, and the threat of annihilation, something that shakes a person to the core, and then something that overwhelms a person's normal adapting or coping skills. So when a person is traumatized, especially a soldier, Marine, airman, or seaman, they often experience something that is way beyond what they are able to cope with in the natural, or what they've been given perhaps in their lifespan up until that point, that in their own development they have coping skills to deal with some things. But when it overwhelms their ability to do so, they've got to find answers to silence those hauntings that are within them.
The other thing, too, I think we've all been there. I know for me, I've been there. Ray, you've been there. That's adrenaline high. I mean, when everything's going to hell in a handbasket, everything's together, and you're functioning at a level beyond anything normally human abilities. And then when you get out into the other mode and things start going sour again, you're looking for that adrenaline high. And you can't get that adrenaline high in your normal life. I mean, you're sitting at a desk or teaching a class or working, doing carpentry or repairing a car. There's not going to be any high coming in. So then it seems to me it'd be so easy to fall back and go, okay, well, I got to get some street drugs, or I have to misuse the prescribed medications that give me that high that I need. Or more than likely, alcohol is the drug of choice.
That's true. And you know, if you look at a lot of the people that do come out of service, they usually go into a more adrenaline type of job, like fire department or law enforcement or different things like that. A lot of them want to go back into Blackwater or different things because they love that adrenaline. And it is an addictive drug, actually. That there's so much to this, but the adrenaline is part of that, and missing it.
Yeah, the adrenaline, and the other one that actually goes up or increases is cortisol. And both adrenaline and cortisol within the human body have a function, but if it's used or secreted more often than it needs to be, it does, over time, break down the body's internal organs. So it's not something that we're supposed to live
on. There was a lot of times when I've had panic attacks, and I've had them through a memory of the traumas, whatever, sight, sound, or smell, that I really thought I was having a heart attack. I thought my body cannot stand this kind of pressure many, many times because it was so powerful, so strong. And it's not that you live for the high. It's just you can't let go of it. It's part of who you are. And, you know, that goes into other things like trying to self-medicate yourself through other forms of alcohol and different things. Girls who have been raped or molested have the same type of adrenaline pumps as we did in combat. You know, it was a life-threatening, like you were talking about. And whatever your life-threatening ordeal was, the adrenaline you experienced was probably the same kind of adrenaline even combat veterans have. I would think so anyway, Doctor. You can say something about that if you...
Yeah, trauma is trauma. I mean, there's different types of trauma, and it's going to still be different for a service member to relate to somebody who perhaps was sexually assaulted and vice versa. But the general common denominator is that they've been traumatized, nevertheless.
Oh, that's true. One thing I wanted to ask you, too, Doctor, is there a different, I know it's a different response thing, but is there a different in adrenaline when you have something that happens to you out of control that you can't do anything about it and you have to respond and your brain is creating adrenaline versus you voluntarily going to do something, jumping off of a building with a pair of wings or something because you want to look brave or something? Is there a difference in the aftermath of that type of adrenaline, or is there a difference in those two different types?
In some ways, yes. Let's say you're talking about somebody who's a daredevil, and for most people, they're going to have some type of preparation. So they have a mindset and a cognitive idea that, okay, I know the risk I'm taking. I've already practiced it perhaps at a lower level or a smaller level, and it's still something I'm relatively prepared to experience. Now, you contrast that with someone who either has been drafted, you know, in your day or is enlisting at this point, and they go through training, they go through basic training, they learn some of the parts of war, they learn their weaponry, they learn what it's like to work as a team, and they have ideas about mission and so on. But to actually experience that which they wind up seeing when their buddies actually die or they get wounded themselves, that's something that you really can't prepare to see.
Sure. That's the memory attached to the adrenaline itself, I guess. And that's why a memory, I can hear something, smell something, see something 20, 30 mm-hmm. years later after the incident that is very reminiscent to the original trauma. And I know one girl told me she was raped one time brutally. Uh-huh. And many years later, she could smell bologna, and it would throw her into a panic mode. And the guy that was raping her had been eating bologna, you know, that day. And so the smell of bologna or the sound of something or the you know, you sense something that is reminiscent, you have that mm-hmm. same adrenaline defensive pump.
We call those triggers.
Right, triggers, that's right.
Yeah.
Those triggers can happen anytime. I know recently this week it's bad for me because I got a very close friend that when I got deployed to Vietnam the first time and the second time, their birthday is coming up this week. So all those memories are just coming back from, you know, 1969, and what is this, 2016? Mm-hmm. So all those dreams and hopes and everything that we had that got disrupted by Vietnam came back into play. And then each one of these things, it just seems like it just, there's these triggers that happen left and right. And recently, again, we got asked, Rollo and I, my sergeant, my battle buddy, we've been together, we've told stories, you know, back to 77. We got asked to come back to ROTC, and we're going to do now. We offer to teach them land navigation in the compass course. They don't have anybody that can do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so us old guys that learn this stuff have to go in because the reliance on technology has got so out of control in the military that these basic tactical and what they're calling analog skills have disappeared.
That's
and
a good point.
So then when you get in the situation where you can't control it, you can't do it, but now you thought you had the knowledge, skills, and attitudes, and you come and find out, oh, my, I don't. I was relying on this thing, and this thing ain't there. It ain't going to work for me. I mean, the electricity is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
It just adds all this together, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Yeah, when you were talking about that, Doug, I remember I taught some classes to, like, Boy Scouts and stuff and about compass, and I showed them how out in the woods, if it's a, you know, get away from the wind and everything, all you need is just a puddle of water and a leaf and a pin, and the pin will actually, you put that pin on top of the leaf, put it in the water, and that the larger part of the pin will turn north because of magnetic north, and so you create a compass if you have to. But, you know, you could find a compass in the middle of the woods, but if you don't know how to read it, it won't do you any good. So, you have to be able to learn.
And to your point, Ray and Doug, is again, that's part of the preparation. If our military today, and it is highly technology-based, then war and battle and combat, despite all the technology that exists, is still man-to-man or woman-to-man or however it is. It's flesh and blood against flesh and blood. And if we are relying and being trained to be relying upon more and more technology, the preparation of what we may see when it comes to flesh and blood contact and combat doesn't get, it actually is taking place even less in terms of preparation.
I something thought I had, Ray. I've never really asked you. The first time I killed somebody, I just, well, we just did it. The second time I had the realization, oh, my God, what have we done? We just dropped 70,000 pounds, and they were down there, and they're obliterated.
Yeah.
The third time from on is, well, hey, this is a part, necessary part of my job. This is my life. This is what I do. I mean, I'm good at it. Mm-hmm. And you just charge on. So what is happening in the brain to allow us to transition from this point to no connection to, oh, my God, to, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's like the morning after, Doug. It's the when you do it, you're responding to a bad situation. You're killing him before he kills you, and you're trying to get the upper hand on him, and your adrenaline is wide open. And I remember after every firefight, you were just wiped out. I mean, you couldn't hardly walk, and you sit down, and you were just wiped out. But it was later, sometime later, that you began to calm down. And many times is when you came home. And then you began to look back. And I remember sitting in Sunday school or in a church one time years later, and I would think about some situation. I start crying in church because I had time to think and more or less rationalize it. Yeah, we were in situations trying to protect ourselves. But yet, I don't think God ever created us to kill each other like that or even kill each other, really. And when we do those type of things, then we come up with something called moral injury, and that kind of goes right into what we're talking about, because it is, Doug shared the same thing when they were dropping bombs. I mean, what am I doing? What am I doing? And then later on, when it kind of kicks in, you think about it. You think, you know, one of my buddies told me one time, and I was writing a book, and we were talking about it, and he said, you know, Ray, he said, killing the enemy did not bother me, and I have to admit to it. It didn't bother me, but he said the way we had to kill some of them did, and because it almost seemed immoral. And so you get into that kind of thing where you're fighting for your life, and you're fighting a guy, but you end up ripping him up with your hands or whatever, or biting him and whatever, because you want to live. And then afterwards you're thinking, good Lord, I just desecrated a human being. And there's always consequences to that type of stuff.
Yeah, follow me if you would. Let me go down this road a little bit. I read somewhere that in our lifetime, we use, in the average human being lifetime, we use 0.001% of the capacity of our brain.
Huh. Wow.
So the capacity that we have to do good is incredible. In contrast, of course, the capacity to do evil is also there.
Right.
But there's another capacity that we tend to be very, very good at and have all kinds of success in doing, at least for a time, and that is to repress memories, to have defense mechanisms in place. Because human nature usually tries to do plan A. Plan A is to avoid pain at all costs. And we have a pretty good capacity to try to do that. Unfortunately, we often have to resort to things like addiction to keep the pain away, to keep it at bay, at arm's length, so it doesn't really overwhelm us. So using a particular example, let's say, of a bombardier, granted, they are trained to go and bomb targets. They know what they're hitting as only targets. There's not too many thoughts of that this is a human element about this. So that is a distant thought that I'm bombing this target and I'm hitting the target, we've had a successful mission. But because the pain of what they've just done is not just about targets, it's about human beings, and the aftermath of that is so far out of their arm's length, they may not see it But if you're dealing with hand-to-hand combat or foxhole-to-foxhole combat, you are seeing the results of your combat.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's not at arm's length. That's right in front of your face.
A trigger thing in this, and I've told this story before, and it's a horrible trigger for me at the same time as an enjoyable trigger. I mean, I had the opportunity to see Bob Hope 3 times in combat, once in Christmas 1969, again Christmas in 1970 over at Nam, and then Christmas of 1990 when we went back to Desert Storm some 20-odd years later. Hmm. And at the end of every Bob Hope show, everybody gets together and sings Silent Night. Well, on Christmas Day in 1970, Christmas Eve actually, went to church, sang Silent Night, went on a bombing mission up north. We had the Christmas tape, and Silent Night was playing on our woolen sack tape recorder right at the time we had to go into our bombing run. So we took that tape off, put the other one on, the mission tape did that, came back, put Silent Night right on. To this day, if I'm in church on Christmas and Silent Night comes up, I'm crying my eyes out.
Wow.
Right. It just kicks those triggers, what you're talking about. We used words, and I know they can be deflammatory, but I'm not using that context. But we use the word gook all the time. And what you didn't realize, I mean, you passed it on from one person to another person, but what you were doing was dehumanizing your enemy to where
yes.
I remember, and I'm going to tell you from a combat veteran stance, the first one that I truly took down and I killed a guy, I didn't even ever think about him being a human being. He was a target. He was what I was hunting for. He was the enemy. Mm-hmm. And when I went through his pockets, I found a wallet. And when I opened it up, it had a picture of his wife and children. And it like hit me between the eyes. And I thought, wow, he was a human being just like me. And it hadn't dawned on me. So I'm not sure that's happened millions of times, you know, with people doing that.
Yeah, and that's a defense mechanism to dehumanize the targets that you face so that you can at least cope with what you just did.
And when you look at trying to find some statistics on all of this in the VA and all over, and it's extremely difficult to find anything on, I did find some diagnostic data for OIF, OEF, OND, and out of an N of 700,000, right at 200,000 already have diagnosed PTSD. This is 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And again, then you have depressive disorders, 150,000, neurotic disorders at 130,000, affective psychoses at 90,000, alcohol dependence syndrome, I guess is what we call alcoholism, at 40,000, non-dependent drug abuse, 30,000, specific non-psychotic mental disorder due to organic brain damage, 25,000. Other stuff not listed, 25,000. And then drug dependence at 22,000. And then sexual deviation disorders at 21,000. These are incredible numbers for young kids that were extraordinarily healthy, and 6 months or later, they're trashed.
Can I add something to that, Doug, because the numbers are horrific. But I've told you before about Camp Lejeune, about I know how some of these bases and these other branches do the same thing, but they allow them to drink in their rooms now. And they told me at Camp Lejeune, a 21-year-old Marine, if it's a PFC, he can have a six-pack a night in his room. Well, you have 3 men in the room, so that's 3 six-packs at night. And out in California, I just came back from San Diego, and one of the Marines out there was telling me that they, with 3 men in a room, you couldn't have more than, or you couldn't, yeah, you couldn't have more than 24 beers in your refrigerator at one time. Now, when it's available to you, you're going to abuse it. I mean, that's all it is to it. You're going to have bad days and bad times and bad memories, and you will be using it. So, what we're doing to our troops now, what they should be doing, is pulling it out and saying, if you want to do something, you have to go to a lounge on base, you have to do something where people can monitor what you're doing. You start getting a little rowdy, they put you out. You start getting a little too much, they put you out. But being in your room, they're creating a lot of problems for our military becoming alcoholics. And then you have prescription drugs, which are legal, but when you mix the two, it's a deadly combination. And we're losing a lot of them from that type of thing.
Well, we also know they're prescribing amphetamines and everything else and sleep drugs, you know, Ambien and everything else, just because the kids can't deal with the psychological aftermath. And so they figure, well, if they can't deal with psychological aftermath from discussion or talk or having somebody shoulder to rely on, we'll just pop them another pill.
Yeah.
It's the same thing,
yeah.
I think, right now here in Illinois. There's a huge discussion about making, and I'm not sure if the governor signed off it or not, they're trying to make marijuana a drug of choice for PTSD treatment. I mean, how nuts does it have to get?
Well, it's marijuana is a sedative, so it does have that effect. But unfortunately, just like any other drug, if it's not used properly or if it's overused, it's going to have a physical detrimental effect on the brain. Too much sedative drugs will, you know, in the vernacular, will fry your brain, and it reduces the ability for the neurotransmitters to do its work. So we tend to slow down in our thought processes. We tend to experience some things that was way beyond what they were meant to help.
Yeah. When I came home from Vietnam, I got into alcohol and drugs pretty heavy, marijuana mainly. But the reason I quit my drugs thing is that, I don't know how many years later it was, but somebody gave me some, wanted me to try it, really great stuff. I took it home and I tried it, and I almost committed suicide that night a couple times. And I found out later it had been mixed with PCP. Nobody told me that. And so you don't know what you're getting, Doc. When you've got some guy, non-pharmacist, over there playing with chemicals, he may want to ramp up a little bit of marijuana. And the first thing you know, once you ingest it, you're there. You can't get rid of it. And so
the regular prescription drugs that are given or prescribed by a physician or a psychiatrist, they're always going to have side effects.
Right.
And those side effects, at least in my experience, my doctorate is not in the medical field, so you know I've had enough clients who have reported to me that some of the side effects are worse than the stuff they're trying to medicate.
Right.
What is this
right.
thing that's coming up? Because I know this doctor I got wanted to prescribe antidepressant, a serotonin inhibitor, or serotonin-connected drug. And, I mean, I had enough knowledge to go, you know, back out. You know, this isn't any good. First off, it's contraindicated with the exposures, toxic exposures I had. The other thing, too, taking a drug is not going to do anything with the moral injury or the depth of that, those problems in there. But what do the serotonin-related drugs do? I mean, they got all the black box warnings on them. If you look at the, drug books and everything, what is happening and why are they trying to do this? It's confusing.
Well, part of what is being trained or is being dealt with in the training of the doctors, psychiatrists in the medical field is the number one answer to people's ailments is medication. And unfortunately, that's the go-to and the default that most medical professionals take care of when they deal with a client or a patient. There are other avenues to take, but it's a very quick one and it's a very simple one, in a sense, to go that route. But what usually occurs is, since every one of us are made differently, we have different body chemistry for the most part, there's genetics involved and so on, but that often has to be monitored because of the side effects that may be affecting person A more than person B. So perhaps the dosage has to be reduced or a different drug altogether may have to be applied in order to have the targeted goal. But again, the side effects could be very difficult to overcome.
And then you have the problem. I know both Ray and I ran into it, and I think I finally got it resolved here recently because I got a new doctor appointed. But our prescription drugs that we needed to maintain physiological function got messed up because the VA got all screwed up. And so we weren't getting refilled on time, and as a consequence, our blood levels of our medications became erratic. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, once that pain sets in, to try and get that pain back under control is a friggin' nightmare. And then anytime I have a psychological impact, and again, maybe, Doc, you can explain this, why does the psychological impact of denied care or stresses or problems in family things have such a physiological effect on pain management and other physiological problems?
Well, it's because we are fearfully and wonderfully made, Doug, as it says in Scripture, and that is that there are we're made up of four components. We are intellectual beings, we are emotional beings, we are spiritual beings, despite even those that may deny that fact, and we are also physical beings. So when something affects one of those four areas, chances are it's going to affect at least one other. So, for example, if you have a mental condition or if you have been traumatized or if there is an emotional dysfunction going on in the person's life, it often has a physiological effect. I can remember in the old days, my dad was growing up, you know, he was a World War II combat Marine, and he struggled with ulcers. And that's a physiological effect of something that was emotional and or mental.
That's right, yeah. Turns into a chemical, turns into everything, you know. So people worry, people have inner, mm-hmm. You know, the thoughts that are always alive and operating, and you're, you know, you try. When I came back, Doc, I said in my book, I said, I was trying to live two lives. I was trying to look normal and act normal, mm-hmm. but I was dying mm-hmm. on the inside. And it caused mm-hmm. a lot of problems. And part of the drinking was more or less self-medication. I didn't want to go to the doctors. I couldn't tell anybody, and so I tried to take care mm-hmm. of myself. And that was mm-hmm. a reprieve. When you're drunk or high, that's a reprieve of, you know, not remembering or maybe not thinking about something or whatever. So people utilize that all the time, but it's a negative thing that grows into worse things.
You know, and Doug, when you were bringing up some of the statistics before about the military personnel, one thing that does get overlooked is, you know, as it relates to suicide, is the long-term suicide. My dad, besides ulcers, sadly passed away as an alcoholic. He drank himself to sleep one night and never woke up, and that was over years and years. So he died in 84, but he ended and left the military soon after World War II was over. So we're talking 40 years later. So that, and I had an uncle, one of his brothers, also died as an alcoholic. So those were long-term suicide or death wishes because of the pain they all had in their own time of war.
Yeah. There's a website. Oh, I'm sorry. But there's a website called suicide.com, and I haven't seen it in a long time, but they listed especially veterans who died of suicide, and even during the Vietnam War and then after the subsequent wars. But a lot of it did have to do with long-term suicide, that many of them drank mm-hmm. themselves to death or did other mm-hmm. things that always tore your body down. And so I truly believe that is a very real thing.
The other thing, too, I think we had to talk about, because of the pain everything's going and the lack of care and lack of concern and lack of compassion and providing proper care, this veteran reaches the end and they don't have any place left to turn. And as a story in Army Times about this young captain, you know, just last Christmas, just committed suicide, and his wife had no clue, no indication, anything had just happened. That the individual's pain was so great on the inside that they had absolutely no place to turn to. They had this mm-hmm. feeling that there was nobody that they could talk to or go to help from. And they just reached that total breakdown where, okay, there's no reason at all to go on. And yet the pain and the suffering then is picked up by all of the family members and loved ones who have to go on day by day without that individual there. And that long-term consequences, Bob, I mean, how do you get counseling or that, or what can we do for that, or how can we protect ourselves from that?
That's a good question. I know the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services say that every addict directly affects at least five other people. And that's not even included if they were to commit suicide. Just the addictive behaviors alone. Unfortunately, what occurs is the individual who needs the help may have heard from others that, oh, by going to counseling or going to see your chaplain or something really doesn't help much. Sometimes they get that feedback. sometimes they think that all within themselves. Sometimes they feel like if I go for help, then that must mean I'm weak. And as a militarily trained warrior, that's the last thing one wants to admit. So oftentimes they choose not to seek help because they don't feel it'll ever help. And that's one of the saddest aspects of this whole thing.
Go ahead, Doug.
What is the preparation for counselors and everything? Bob, you run an organization for Christian counselors and providing guidance. Is there any consistency across the preparation for counselors, whether they be in the military or the VA or civilian? And is there different preparation? I mean, obviously, got to be distinctive, different preparation for somebody dealing with military veteran versus somebody that's just, you know, in college or, you know, home, a normal, everyday veteran individual. How does that all change, and what can we do, or is that what you're working towards, consistency and response?
Yeah, and this, just like any other field these days, there are specialties, and in my case, as a trained counselor, I came out of my master's level school and becoming licensed. I did not begin working with military personnel because I myself did not serve directly in the military. Although I had my father, as I said, and I've had two sons who served, but I did not. So when I had the opportunity to work near Fort Bragg, I worked under a clinical director who himself was a 29-year retired lieutenant colonel, Army Ranger. So he was able to speak both languages, both in terms of the military as well as in terms of counseling. And I asked him questions upon questions upon questions, and I basically had him train me to be effective. I thought I was a pretty good counselor. I thought I was a pretty effective counselor. But when I had to deal with that particular population, I was clueless until I learned what I had to do and how to be sensitive to that, how to speak their language, how to respect that which they've experienced. And all of that was in a process type of a thing. And the training that most counselors go to and go through, I should say, right now through universities, they may have a class or a part of class on perhaps trauma-related issues. And the military may be tossed in there as a token idea. The ones who are the most effective are the ones like myself who are willing to learn what it really takes to be effective with that population, or a military person, him or herself, who maybe was a chaplain, or maybe as they leave the military, go on to school, use a GI Bill, and become a counselor for that population because they know firsthand the high need that there is for someone to relate to them.
It seems like one of the experiences I've had and I've heard before is you go into a counselor again looking for help, and they immediately call you Mr. or whatever, trying to separate you out from your military service. Well, both neither Ray or I could ever be separated from our military service because that was part of our life and always be part of our life. And it doesn't matter. It seems to me it doesn't matter if you were in for 6 months or 35 years. That is your life, and it's going to always be part of your life. So if we're going to do a continuing education and preparation, it has to be the first thing does understanding who the person is that you're providing care to. And what does their life consist of? In other words, I guess in the medical field, we just talk about doing a solid, sound case history.
Dr. Shaw.
Yeah, when I started with my clients, I would begin to ask them things like, you know, where they served and what rank they may be. And I actually have asked them, how would you like me to address you? And oftentimes, if it's an officer, they say, well, you can call me Major. So early going, I would definitely do that. But as the sessions went on, it became a little bit more personal, and I would have the permission to call them by first name. But I had to learn to respect, like you said, that's their identity, and that's what they're used to being addressed by, and I had to respect that.
Right. I do some classes at Camp Lejeune, and one of those classes is called Prevail. And when you go in there, everybody takes their rank off. So no one has a rank. So that's a little bit different. The other ones I do have, you know, different the people are sitting there with the chevrons on or bars, whatever it is. But that's one of the things of everybody gets on the same level. But what I found out, that me personally, I think if a veteran who have found help and you know, part of mine is through Christ who gave me peace, and the scripture said he will keep you in perfect peace as, you know, so long as your mind is stayed on him, and because, you know, you depend on him, basically. But there's a lot of things that we've learned along the way about overcoming and going from surviving to thriving and things like that. And if we would turn around and get one, you know, or what they say sometimes, reach one, teach one, or whatever they want to do. If we just talk to our friends more often, people that we do associate with, even veterans and different ones, we would be able to at least turn their lives in a right positive direction and get them some help. But I think a lot of veterans have really failed. Doug and I and Denise and different ones who served before, that's what we're trying to do, is reach people. And that helps me and helps all, I'm sure it helps Doug and Denise both. When you're helping other veterans to find the help that you found, that's very rewarding.
It's very rewarding. I absolutely agree. Plus, you have that additional connection between the two of you that makes a big difference.
Yes, yeah, true.
Boy, there's just so much here. I guess every time I read a story again, like I started out this program, here's this Vietnam vet that for years and years and years he couldn't deal with it. He didn't want to accept it, didn't want to recognize what happened. Obviously, from the story, he had significant problems before he went in that were exacerbated beyond comprehension there as a Marine door gunner. I mean, Ray, you could explain to us what that is. I can't even begin to imagine that at all.
Yeah.
How do we go forward? I mean, we got to make these individual choices. And Ray, I mean, you're always talking about choices. You've got this thing where you go out, how to avoid the hook.
Right.
I mean, to me, it seems like that's the critical thing here, is how do we make the conscious choice to move forward? Because we can all excel, we can all achieve greatness within our own domain.
Right.
But we have to avoid what you call the hook, don't we?
We do, and you have to be able to identify it, first of all, and know what. What I try to do is I go into, I've done it about 150 to 200 different venues, and everything from, you know, college or school, high school kids, ROTC, junior high, elementary schools, and what I try to do is reach these children, and it's called Watch Out for the Hook, and so I have a big hook that I show them. It's got three parts. It's got a point, a barb, and then a shaft that determines which size fish you go after. And then I have a handful of hooks that I pick up and I crush them in my hand, and when I let go of them, there's one or two that always sticks in me. So the idea is if you play with them, you're going to get hooked. And then I show them what a lure looks like, a fishing lure. I show them several different ones. They look like bugs or little fish or something. But they have several things in common. They're always shiny, they're always brightly colored, they're always attractive, and all of them have hidden hooks in them. And then I take them into the commercial world of life itself, out into the grocery stores and places, and I tell them, I said that those same four characteristics is what the commercial industries have used for their advertisement. And so I bring out, like, for instance, a Budweiser can. It's got a big steel hook sticking through it. And I show them the brightly colored, the shiny, the pretty. It makes it attractive. And I talk to them about how alcohol addiction actually starts out usually in junior high school somewhere. And then you get hooked. You get addicted in three different ways. You get addicted to the substance, to the places they go to drink, and the people that go there. And so suddenly your life is spinning out of control. And when you try to not go there, the other two powers are trying to pull you back in. And it's like you get sucked up into things. And I have, like, alcohol, drugs, pornography, gambling, and a couple other things that I have in there. And they're all the same way, Doug. You have to be able to identify them. You have to realize you're being fished into this deal. And just because it's shiny, you know, it doesn't mean it's gold. And you have to be careful of realizing what's out there. You know, when you catch that fish, Doug, and you start pulling him in and everybody's hollering, get him, get him, get him, everybody's having a great time except for the fish. He's not having a good day. That hook is tearing him up. And every time he tries to quit, that hook is there to remind him. And he's being pulled away from everything he knows as a fish. And as a young person gets into drugs or alcohol, their life starts being pulled. They start getting pulled away from the people they love, the places they love, the people they grew up with. And suddenly they're being drugged away into a world of hurt and pain. And so I'm sure Dr. Shaw has probably programmed something the same way.
Yeah. You know, I have seen and addressed and read how addictions can be equated with idols. And we are in a time in history where idols are not mentioned very much like they were in the Old Testament or like they were maybe in other nations and other cultures. But we still have idols in our lives today. They just are not necessarily blocks of wood or metal or so on, or golden calves. And one of them is addictions, because, you know, it can become your false lover, because you love, you serve that which you love. And if it serves you, you go back all the more. So if the capacity and the desire is for us to do, well, addictions do one of two things, generally speaking. Number one, they silence the negative messages that roll around in our heads, that produce all kinds of negative noise. We want to silence those in the worst way. And oftentimes addictions will attempt to do that. Also, secondly, we seek out addictions because we want to medicate pain, or both. And the pain that someone feels when they've been traumatized or when they've experienced combat trauma is can be very excruciating, so therefore they want to medicate that. Now, medication doesn't make it go away. It just makes it livable. And that's why the increase or the additional need for it to escalate so that it can meet what was being done before is going to be a danger. So,
sure.
Yes, addictions can silence messages and or medicate pain. But those are just they're just dealing with symptoms. They're not really going after the root.
What data is there out there? What proportion of the population would be the hook and the bait to pull people in, versus what proportion of the population would be out there to help the person get away and get free? I mean, how do you select those individuals? How do you meet those individuals? Where are they at? And what are their proportions between one versus the other? It's a very difficult question. I don't know if we can answer it.
I don't know what the numbers are, Doug, to be honest. I know in the VA, hospitals, when they try to set up counseling, it's almost always group therapy, because they want to have the idea that, you know, there are others who are struggling just like you are, and perhaps together we can kind of surf through all this. Oftentimes what I have found in the feedback that I've gotten from my military clients is, yeah, that can be partially helpful, but I get tired of hearing the same old regurgitated. That's not really helping me in the long term.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them are like some kind of self-help, and, you know, you don't have to do this. But when you're deep into addiction, you're over your head in some things, and you don't even know you have it until you try to quit it, and then suddenly you can't quit it. But I do tell them this, Dr. Shaw. I said, I used to drink when I came back from Vietnam for the first 10 years. I drank all the time. I mean, I worked sometimes three jobs, but I still drank when I wasn't working. And I said, one night I was in a bar about 10 years after all this happened, and I said, I was sitting there and drinking a beer, and I was already looking around the people I were looking at. Now, I had a nice home, and I had a couple of cars, and I had to work a lot to get them. But I said, you know, I got looking at these people, and I thought, what am I doing? I don't even want to be like these people. I don't even like these people. I don't want to take these people home with me, and I want my kids around. And I thought, what am I doing? And I put my beer down, and I made one conscious decision. I said, I am not doing this anymore. I got out, and I walked out and got my truck, and I went home. And that's been 36 years ago. I went from a total alcoholic to total sobriety by one conscious decision. I'm going to do something different. I'm not doing this anymore. Mm-hmm. And look, Doctor, I've had people tell me, say, well, I don't want to lose my friends. I said, I didn't lose my friends. I said, my friends lost me. Because when I quit doing what they were doing, I wasn't part of the group. I just started doing what was right for me and my family. And your group will let you go. I mean, because that's the only thing that held us together anyway, was the alcohol.
Yeah, and how much really were they friends? If that's all you were doing, how much help were you giving one to another?
Yeah, right. So we came from a lot of bad places, our marriages and everything, mm-hmm. Alcohol-related problems and stuff. And we get together in a bar, and we call it partying. And then by the time you spend most of your money and you go home, you might get a DWI on the way home. But when you get home, you're back in the same problems again, only it's even worse now. And so, you know, they call it partying, but that's really that's not a correct word for what you're doing. You're just feeding the addiction, what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean,
go ahead, Doug, I'm sorry.
It comes back to individual choices. I mean, today, whether you're in Illinois or any place in the United States, if you went into the military, if you spent any time on it all, I think it's 6 months and beyond, especially 2 to 4 years, you have all the full educational benefits that come back to school to get mm-hmm. an academic or vocational education or a mixture of academic and vocational education to achieve greatness in your lifetime. I mean, that's a conscious choice. And I think when I came back from Vietnam in June of 71 and got out, you know, fully out in September of 71, 3 days later I was in school. Well, right. When I got into school, I didn't have time to do drinking or doing drugs. I had to pass my courses, pass my grades, and get out because in 71 I knew, hey, if I mess up, hey, I'm going back to Vietnam. You know, like, this is not a good thing to have happen. So how can we get individuals to make these choices? Because, you know, the president of Canada is saying, well, we want to provide a free college education to everybody. Hey, it's already there if you're serving the military. You got free admission to college once you get out. But, yes, you have to make the grade. Yes, you have to make the conscious choice. Yes, you have to exceed based on your own effort and accepting the help of all those around you that truly care and not, as Ray, as you're saying, will drag you down into oblivion.
It does. It you do have the power of how you respond to things. And just because we got in some problems, and you take a young lady who's been molested or something, she didn't ask for that, but now she's stuck with the remembrance of it and the adrenaline pumps that turn into panic attacks, and she has all these problems. But there comes a point in time where you have to just say, look, I cannot allow my past to control my future any longer. I've got to make some decisions. And in a classroom setting, I get them, each person to say, I look at them and I said, do you want to get better? And they say, yeah, yes, 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 all the way around. And I said, you're going to have to make one first decision. From that point on, you're able to talk to people, professionals and such. And but I think it comes with that first decision of saying, I want to get better.
How many people have the academic knowledge and vocabulary to understand stuff when you're offering help or explaining these things? I mean, what I've seen, and I've taught from kindergarten through graduate school now, and especially the younger kids, too many of them in the military don't have the academic vocabulary. How can we relate to them and explain something to them that has a higher level of knowledge required or a lot better vocabulary than what they have? Because it's sort of like...
You know, That's a good question. What I've tried to do and has a good level of success, Doug, is try to use some of the phrases and or cliches that a military service member has learned in their training. And three of them that usually come up for me when I'm working with somebody are these. One of them is never give up. You're trained as a military person, as a warrior, as a soldier, Marine, Airman, Seaman, to never give up. So let's speak that language. What does that mean to you? That doesn't mean that you're just surviving. That means that you can thrive and make better decisions and keep moving forward by never giving up. And there's a lot of things that are attached to that, but that speaks their language at their level. The second one is leave nobody behind. And if you're addressing somebody who's struggling with addictions, let's say, and the effect that they're having on at least five people, according to statistics, in a sense, they're leaving people behind, their loved ones. So perhaps you can address it in that through that angle. And the third one is, it's all about the mission. So what I would try to do is frame it to let them see that, okay, your mission as a military service member is now over. You are out of the military. You've had these experiences. It's affecting you. What is your mission now? Oh, I don't really know. Okay, well, let's design one. Part of your training was you had a mission that was designed just for you. So let's design a mission and let's make it a part of your mission. And that can, and that usually gets some legs to work with.
Well, part of what I do too, Doc, is I know you do the same thing. And when you're talking to people who are hurting, and I have two areas I try to work on, and one is post-traumatic stress from whatever area they came through that has caused it, whether it's military or even civilian. But also the other part is moral injury, because I know they've been spiritually wounded. They may have been coerced. Doug talked much about that, of being forced into do certain things, and that he knew was against the conscience, more or less, or were made to do certain things or whatever. It always leaves you wounded or with a guilty conscience. And so I talked to them about the spiritual ramifications of going through life with that wounded conscience, and how we can, all you have to do is ask God, look up and say, God, if you're real, prove it to me. I want to know it. And ask him nicely, because he can probably hurt you if you wanted to, because God is real. But when you when you seek God, you will find him, and he can give you peace that you would have never imagined. He can actually take whatever's in the past and ball it up and throw it into into the darkness.